This is Ozarks at Large. Thomas Hilton cares about towns and cities in the United States. He is the author of the book Save Our Land, Save Our Towns, and the president of a nonprofit organization of the same name. Both the book and the organization make the case for comprehensive, forward-thinking city planning. His articles about urban sprawl, the need to re-examine our car culture, and on better ways for people of all ages, abilities, and economic levels to interact with each other are published in newspapers around the country. In 1990, by the way, he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing while the editor of the Mercury, the daily paper in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Thomas Hilton will speak on the University of Arkansas campus Thursday, April 4th, and he is with me on the phone. Thomas Hilton, thank you for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Was there a singular event or series of events that led you to lead a crusade for smart city planning?
Yes, there was, as a matter of fact. I live in a traditional pedestrian-oriented town of Pottstown, which is about 35 miles northwest of Philadelphia, has about 22,000 people. And in 1982, our school district had a lovely high school across the street from my house, which they decided to close because of a declining enrollment, and they demolished the high school. And it was such a waste of a great building, and they're building new ones on the fringe outside of town, that it really got me thinking about how we haven't really been improving our quality of life by sprawling out into the countryside and abandoning our traditional towns. So that's what got me started.
You make the case in your book and in the documentary that's been on many PBS stations, that the right kind of planning can, and this is a limited list, but can lower the cost of living, revive inner cities, protect the environment, and provide equal opportunities for children. You place much of how a city and its people thrive on smart planning, don't you?
That's correct.
What is the single biggest error that cities seem to make when planning?
Well, for most of human history, we built all our communities on a walking scale. And a walking scale is based on the fact that the average person can walk 300 feet a minute. So the average person can walk a mile in about 15 or 20 minutes. And so since that's a normal commute that people have been used to taking, since the beginning of civilization, right up through the 1800s, we have planned all our towns so that you could walk from one place to another. And even in the 1800s, when trains came along and when trolleys came along, you still had to walk to the train station or the trolley stop. With the advent of the car in the early 1900s, it became possible, certainly after the Second World War, it became possible to move your buildings anywhere, and you could start sprawling all over the countryside. Initially, this seems like a great thing because you can move out there in the countryside and enjoy a spacious yard, fresh air, and so forth. But as we've been doing this over the last four or five decades in ever-increasing amounts, we've emptied out our traditional cities and towns. Now we have to support two infrastructures, the original infrastructure of our cities and towns, which don't have the money and the resources to keep them up, and then a new, very expensive, sprawling infrastructure all over the countryside. And creating all this pavement, which sprawl requires, because while a person is only taking up about 3 or 4 square feet of space, a car is going to take up 100 square feet of space, and then to park it, that's going to be 400 square feet of space. So we've turned an enormous amount of our landscapes into pavement for roads and for parking lots, and it has a detrimental impact on the environment and on our cost of living.
I think a lot of people associate the beginning of urban sprawl with the spread of suburbia maybe in the 1950s. But you write that many of the policies that have led to some of the bad planning decisions stretch back to the 1930s.
That's correct. If you recall, Franklin Roosevelt becomes president. He's facing the greatest economic depression we had ever seen. He brings together a cabinet of experts, and they're brainstorming, and they're saying, hey, we should go out there and use all this vacant space out there in the countryside. It'll be a great idea for people to do. And they came up with things, for example, as public housing. Let's create public housing. And they would put that in the cities and towns, and they'd concentrate poor people in certain neighborhoods. At the same time, they started offering incentives for people to move out of traditional towns. And It didn't really take off in the 30s, even though the plans were all laid, the ideas were hatched in the 30s. We really didn't have the money during the Depression to build much of anything. And then in the early 40s, of course, we're fighting the Germans and the Japanese in the Second World War. But when the war ends, now there's a tremendous demand for housing. The servicemen are coming home and getting married. We have built up an enormous economic capacity. The rest of the world is in shambles from the war, but we have built up this tremendous capacity to manufacture things. We are by far the wealthiest nation on earth at that point. And so Dwight D. Eisenhower, who had seen the Autobahn over in Germany, which is the first limited access high-speed highway system, he thought that was great. And so after the war, he goes to Congress, and they decide that we're going to build an interstate highway system, which is basically modeled on the Autobahn in Germany. In fact, in my state of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Turnpike was the first limited access highway. And that really fostered the people of moving out of cities and towns all across America out into the countryside. Because while the Germans built the Autobahn, they also have very strict land controls about where you can build things, whereas in this country, we didn't. So as we built these highways, we made it really, really easy and attractive to move out of the cities and towns.
What if the toothpaste is out of the tube, though? Recently, trips have taken me to a pair of cities, Surprise, Arizona, and Duluth, Georgia, where the car is king, sidewalks end without warning, and crosswalks are treated like as a suggestion by motorists and not a commandment. Can cities like that, and Surprise is not a huge city. I don't know the population. It's probably about 3,000, but the traffic is horrible, stoplight after stoplight. Can cities like those be saved?
Well, they're going to have to be, and Americans are very good at adapting to circumstances, and circumstances are now going to be forcing us, basically through global warming, on all the impacts that creates. Circumstances are going to force us, and plus the tremendous amount of debt that we've built up, are going to force us to rethink how we arrange our landscapes. And just as it took 50 years to really undermine all our cities and towns across America, it's going to take several decades to go back the other way. But it's already happening. For example, just near me, the city of Philadelphia, which was 100 years ago was the third largest city in the United States, and then now way down, had for 50 years constantly lost population. Well, for the first time since 1950, the city is now gaining population because people are beginning to see the advantages of living in communities where you can walk places you need to go.
Does bad planning contribute to disparities in socioeconomic levels?
Well, we had come up with this idea of, and it started in the 30s with the Federal Housing Administration, about providing mortgages to people, and the bureaucrats came up with the definition of what a house should look like and how many acres, how much land it should be on, and that houses should be segregated from stores, which should be segregated from workplaces. So all this zoning, really, that came about was cooked up in the 30s but really implemented with a vengeance in the 50s and the 60s, all of this really encouraged people to separate themselves from each other. And so, yeah, if you want to call that bad planning, I've been to a lot of places that would say, you know what, if we had never gotten into zoning in the first place, we'd probably be better off. And as I like to say to people, if you go back 100 years ago, when there was no zoning at all, no environmental restrictions, no big government, where was everybody living? Well, they were living in traditional cities and towns. Why? Because it made economic sense. It wasn't until the government came along, built the interstate highway system, started subsidizing water and sewer lines all over creation, came up with zoning that said, we're going to have a separate area, this separate area of a community is for offices, and this area over here is for factories, and this area here is for single-family houses, and this area is for apartments, and we're just going to hop in our cars and drive in between all these zones. Well, it doesn't work.
Wow. So are you advocating for less zoning?
I'm advocating for thinking about a culture change. Zoning can be good if it's done properly. And I actually wrote the zoning ordinance for our town of Pottstown, in which we're looking at, in our zoning ordinance, first of all, we're giving discretion to the municipality to do the right thing, but we're more interested in how things fit together and what they look like than actually separating land uses. So there's nothing wrong with having apartments and offices and single-family houses all in the same place if they're designed pleasantly. Parking lots, you don't want a huge sea of parking. And we require far more parking than we need in this country to accommodate the number of cars. You know, a parking lot is built for Christmas Eve, you know, and everybody is out shopping, and the rest of the year it's empty. Well, we don't want to think that way. We want to think in terms of how can we encourage our communities to be attractive and walkable through zoning, but not by separating things.
In Northwest Arkansas, we have some revived downtowns, Bentonville and Fayetteville, Rogers, Asylum Springs, even Springdale's thinking about it. And people like those inner cores. But what also happens is the bigger towns are where the jobs are. And some people cannot afford the housing in those towns, so they live in the smaller towns that are away. We don't have mass transit to speak of. And so these folks who need the jobs in the town but can afford the living out of town have to drive their cars. And so mass transit might be an answer. But if you're west of the Mississippi and you don't have that infrastructure and has been built, that's very expensive to implement.
That's correct. And it's necessary to be creative in finding ways to find infill housing so you can create more housing near where the jobs are. Another trend that's really helpful this way is, you know, people, more and more people are working out of their houses. The internet is connecting everyone. You can do a multiple of jobs with only having to go into an office maybe once or twice a week. My nephew works for Google, and he lives in eastern Pennsylvania, and twice a week he commutes by bus to Manhattan where the Google office is, but the other 3 days he works out of his house. So we're seeing that increasingly happen. And if you can work anywhere, if you can work in your home anywhere, then you're going to be more attractive to more interested in living in an attractive community that has sidewalks and street trees and distinctive architecture and has lots of nightlife and things to do. And so you'd rather be in a town because the job is where you are. It's not necessarily something you have to commute to. That's an increasing trend.
Thomas Hilton is the author of the book Save Our Land, Save Our Towns, the president of the nonprofit organization of the same name. You can learn more at saveourlandsaveourtowns.org. He'll speak on the University of Arkansas campus Thursday, April 4th. Thomas Hilton, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thank you.
Support for KUAF comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, featuring food and catering and event planners in the April 1st edition, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. The current edition is available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com, where you can also register for daily business e-news.